My mom says you don't ask your child if they want to go to the protest. You ask them, what shirt do you want to wear to the protest, your red one or your blue one?
From NPR and Futuro Media, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. And today, a conversation between Dolores Huerta and her own daughter. ...2018 has been a year of reckoning around the power of women's voices, from the testimony of Christine Blasey Ford to the many women who have been a part of the Me Too movement. And it's been a year in which women all across the country have been speaking up, in the workplace, in protests on the street, and on the campaign trail. On this election day, a record-breaking number of women are on the ballot. So today on our show, we're doing a partnership with WNYC's United States of Anxiety podcast. This season, they've been examining the role of gender in politics, from the first woman elected to Congress in 1916 to the midterm elections. And for this episode, we wanted to hear from someone who's made a career of publicly fighting for change.
Come on up, brothers. We are waiting for you.
We welcome back an old friend of Latino USA's, lifelong civil rights activist Dolores Huerta, to help us reflect on this moment of women at the forefront. Along with Cesar Chavez, Dolores Huerta helped found the United Farm Workers Union, and she became iconic for her rally cry, Si se puede, yes we can. Dolores Huerta grew up in Stockton, California, and her work is mostly focused on agricultural workers in the Central Valley. Now, I've interviewed Dolores Huerta many times in the past, but this time, the 88-year-old sat down with her own daughter, Juana Chavez, who interviews her mom about her experiences with gender and power, both in her work as an activist in a predominantly male-led union, as well as at home with her family. Juana starts off the conversation.
Your first job was as a public school teacher, as was mine. And I was just wondering what initially drew you to teaching.
I always worked. From the time that I was 14 years old, I always tried to find jobs. And I worked a whole bunch of different jobs. I worked cutting apricots in a packing shed. I worked in a jewelry store. I worked selling candy. I worked in a department store selling music records, but then I got married and ended up getting a divorce after having two children, my oldest two daughters, Celeste and Lori. So then I took a job as a school teacher because that way my hours would be the same as my daughters. And so that's why I became a school teacher.
You grew up in the 40s and the 50s, mm-hmm. and you were of the same generation as my father, Richard Chavez. You were both activists, but in my recollection, there was some tension in the house. For instance, one time I remember there was an argument between the both of you because it was getting pretty late and he wanted us to do the dishes and we had an important homework assignment to complete. And so you were defending our right to do our homework rather than do the dishes. And I remember that argument. How did you deal with that?
Well, we had many, many arguments. The dishes were a big factor because he somehow felt that men and my son, Rick, shouldn't have to do the dishes. And, you know, I felt just the opposite. I felt that they had to also chip in with the housework, you know, because he was a first-generation Mexican-American. My family grew up very, very differently because we had been here for generations in the United States. And so he thought girls should be married off as soon as they were 16, 17 years old. So we had these huge, huge arguments and fights.
It was challenging because you want the acceptance of your mother and your father. So it was sometimes challenging for me personally to balance that, to want to show that I was strong, independent, and a feminist, and I wanted to please you. And at the same time, I didn't want to disappoint my father. So trying to show him, like, look, I know how to cook. Look, I know how to clean, you know, so don't think I'm a total failure as a woman. But inside, I always felt okay for my mother. I'm being who I really want to be and who I plan to be. And for my father, I'm doing it for him. Do you remember making a conscious choice to have children? And what was that thought process like for you?
Well, I always loved children, and I guess that's why I had so many of them. From the time I was a teenager, I would babysit for all my friends. They didn't have to pay me anything. I still love children a lot. And I know that there's been a lot of criticisms by people say, well, yeah, you love children so much, but you sure didn't do a very good job of taking care of them. Because in my work, I had relatives helping me care for my children. I had friends. I had, you know, sometimes people that I barely met helping me take care of my children. But they all survived. Juanita, you have a really good line that I've heard you say sometimes when you speak publicly. You say, we didn't have play dates, we had picket line days.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we didn't have play dates, we had picket line dates. I remember that you took us with you often into situations where I think many working mothers would rather just find someone to take care of their kids because, you know, you're going to the state capitol to do lobbying. One time I remember you took us into the capitol with you. I think that you had a specific mission and a reason for bringing us with you.
Well, yes, and I think we were trying to track down one particular senator and he was trying to avoid me. And so I asked you to run up ahead of me and catch him, which you did. Because sometimes when we're lobbying for something, some of the people that are there in the Capitol are really trying not to talk to you because they know that you're going to be pressuring them to vote a particular way on a particular measure. And so I guess I asked you to help me track that senator down.
Yeah. He was booking it. He was clearly not trying to stop for you. And you were calling his name, Senator, Senator. And he kept going. And so at one point you just yelled, please don't make me chase you. I have my children with me. And he just stopped, exasperated, just slumped his shoulders and turned around and just like, what, Dolores? So I thought that was a really good tactic to get him to pay attention to you. But I thought that was also so exciting. It was really wonderful to have such an adventurous, exciting life outside of the classroom. It's like our life at school was challenging. We were discriminated against. We were looked down on for our poverty, for our skin color, for the beliefs and ideals that our family upheld. There was an incident that happened in high school, and I've told the story often. At the time, I felt it was a lesson in humiliation. But as an adult reflecting upon it, I realized it was a lesson in materialism, in pride. You've heard me tell the story from my version many times, and so I'm wondering if you can tell your version of the story and what you were thinking.
I guess the background of this story is that when we worked with United Farm Workers, we didn't get wages. Most of our clothes for the kids came from donations. And so obviously they did not have the best or the richest clothes to wear.
We also, we got food stamps.
Yeah, food stamps.
And I remember that in the store, like the tellers, like they would, you know, shame us. You felt like shame for mm-hmm. using food stamps.
And then we had these old cars that we used to drive, these old Valiants. And so one day when I was taking the kids to school, they wanted me to drop them off a couple of blocks away from the school because they were embarrassed to be seen in this old beat up Valiant that I was driving them in. But what I did is I took them right in front of the school and honked the horn and dropped them off. And they were very upset with me.
It was terribly embarrassing. We were just hoping you wouldn't force us out and keep driving, but you, of course, made us get out and go to school. And the front of the school was where all the popular kids would hang out in the morning before school with all of their latest fashions. And so it was very embarrassing. Now it's funny, but at the time it was pretty devastating.
Coming up on Latino USA, Dolores Huerta on how she learned to take credit for her own work and how to play power games with men. Stay with us. No te vayas.
This message comes from NPR sponsor ESPN. The critically acclaimed 30 for 30 documentary series is now a podcast featuring original audio stories from the world of sports, the heroes, the controversies, and how what happens on the field can change everything. Listen to the new season of 30 for 30 on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts.
Sam Sanders here. This week I'm talking to Abby Jacobson. You know her from her Comedy Central show, Broad City. We're going to talk about a solo cross-country road trip Abby took recently and why she wrote a book all about it. That is on the latest episode of It's Been a Minute from NPR.
Hey, we're back with Dolores Huerta and her daughter, Juana Chavez. Now, as a young school teacher, Dolores Huerta saw many of her own students, the children of farm workers, living in poverty.
California's San Joaquin Valley holds some of the richest farmland in the United States. Yet those who work the vineyards live in poverty.
So she quit and became an organizer instead, and later joined forces with Cesar Chavez. And together, they started the United Farm Workers Union in 1962. During the famed Delano grape strike of 1965, they convinced 17 million people to boycott grapes across the United States. In the end, they were able to broker one of the first ever union contracts for farm workers.
Cesar Chavez held a news conference today in Delano, California, and announced that his United Farm Workers Organizing Committee had signed contracts with growers producing 80% of California's table grapes.
Since then, she hasn't slowed down. In 2002, she began her own foundation. And in 2017, she became an honorary co-chair of the Women's March.
Sisters all over the world who are marching today, because we are saying in a very big, loud voice with our bodies, we will not go back. Let's say it all together. We will not go back. We will not go back. Everything in this world has come from the body of a woman.
Despite many decades in activism, though, it's only more recently that Dolores has been fully recognized for her work. We now pick up Dolores' conversation with her daughter, Juana Chavez, about her experiences navigating gender and power dynamics in activism.
So when you first started getting into organizing, was there like an aha moment or a moment where you felt like, yes, this is my path?
Well, actually, that aha moment came when I went to my first house meeting. Seeing pictures of 100 people in a meeting, I had never seen more than 20 or 30 people in a meeting in my entire life. And I was pretty active in many organizations. So that really impressed me. And it really showed me visually that people could really make changes if they just came together and acted collectively, taking direct action, that they could do these miraculous things, something that I had always wanted to see happen. Because as a young person growing up, a young woman of color, we were constantly harassed by the police, discriminated in our schools by our school teachers. You know, we always felt so helpless that there's nothing that you could do. But then when you saw the people in East Los Angeles were accomplishing, I thought, whoa, it was like finding a gold mine. A gold mine of power, you might say.
When you started organizing, were you working with men and women, or was it mostly male-dominated?
It was, I guess, kind of equal with men and women. Of course, when I started working with United Farm Workers, there were many women that were in the fields, but not that many women in terms of leadership.
Was there any tension around that?
Well, I think the tension that I felt as a leader and as the initial organizer, along with Cesar Chavez of the Farm Workers Union, it didn't come so much from Cesar himself, but I think from other men on the board. There was always, I felt like, a sort of a competition, or some of them didn't really respect my position in the union.
I remember you coming home and being frustrated. And you didn't necessarily say, because they're men and I'm a woman. So I'm just wondering if there was a particular moment that you remember to be frustrating, and how you were able to deal with it.
Well, one of the things that I learned is that I had to be strategic in trying to accomplish what I wanted to accomplish, and also to keep it to myself, because then I found that oftentimes I would start a project and then it would be assigned to somebody else after I had initiated it. And so we had a big freeze in the oranges in California, and many thousands of farm workers were out of work. So what I did is I just kept my strategy to myself. But I went to Washington, I got assistance from FEMA. And so we ended up getting all of these millions of dollars to help these workers out. And then I had a press conference after I got put it all together. But I didn't tell anybody what I was doing until I had the press conference. And then everybody got to see what I was doing. It's like playing a card game, and you're keeping your cards to yourself. You're not going to show your cards until you know that you have a winning hand, so to speak. And I think sometimes it's hard for women to do this. And I think these are things that we as women have to learn from men. I mean, there are lessons that we can learn from them, especially the power games.
Has that been easy for you? Have you always thought it was important to take credit for your work?
Well, at the beginning, I really didn't think very much about that. But some of the men in the union, I remember that one vice president once at a big gathering that we had of leadership of the farm workers, literally stood up and gave a report taking credit for all of my work in New York City on the boycott. And luckily, I spoke after him. And I did say, I'm sorry, but I'm the one that did all of that work. And he was furious with me afterwards. And he said, why did you embarrass me that way? And I said, well, I said, why did you take credit for my work? You know?
I have some resentment, or that I've held a grudge for many years against the leadership of the United Farm Workers. And that's, you know, just a personal feeling that I've had, that you have not gotten enough credit, or that they don't still give you enough credit.
Well, number one, when you do the kind of justice work that we do, you don't do it to get credit in the first place. I mean, you do it to help other people. In the work that I've been blessed to be engaged in, there have been thousands of people that have made it happen. When you think of the 17 million people that didn't buy grapes, and the hundreds of farm workers that went to jail, and five of our farm workers that were murdered, and just trying to get the basic human rights for farm workers, the right to have a union, and people don't know their names. I have been so blessed and been recognized at the highest levels of, you know, with getting the Presidential Medal of Freedom from President Obama, being the first Latina in the National Women's Hall of Fame. So, I mean, I feel that I have been more than recognized. But I think that women often, that we are shy of being recognized. And so I just want to say to all the women out there, when you need to take credit for the work that you do, just channel Oprah. Channel Oprah. And, you know, yes, we need to be humble, but we also need to be proud.
I remember I was in my early 30s, and my partner at the time and I spoke to you. We announced to the family that we were planning on starting a family. And I remember saying to you, hey, you know, my partner and I are, we had to plan it because obviously as two women, we could not conceive a child together. So, you know, we mentioned to you and other family members that were there that we were going to start planning our family. And I remember kind of your just knee-jerk reaction was like, well, why would you want to do that? Once you have kids, your life is over or something like that. And we, you know, were sitting there with a couple of your children. So it was like, we all looked at you like, what? What are you talking? You know, so.
Well, when I say that, once you have children, your life is very different because you have to make a commitment to those children. And you have to be responsible. And maybe once they're adults, you think, well, I don't really have to be responsible for what happens to them anymore. But it's still there. You have to worry about them, about their love life, their finances, or, you know, if they're ill or whatever. It impacts on a parent a lot.
I'm certainly not an activist on the level that you are, Mom. I mean, as you know, my plan to have children did not pan out. But I still find it challenging. I don't have children, and I still, you know, find it challenging to be an activist. I think that you're the gold standard and the bar that I'm trying to reach, and I always feel like I fall short of that. You know, for young women today, for activists who might ask you about the subject of having children, and what advice would you give to the young women who are activists and want to have children or do have children?
Number one, I think everybody needs to be an activist in one way or the other. And I know sometimes it's hard because we all have a lot of work in our personal lives and in our work lives, but we need to take a few hours of our life to become activists, a few hours a week, whether it's to do phone banking, canvassing, to get involved in some environmental work, whatever it may be, we need to do that. And never be ashamed of being an activist. Be proud of it, even when people make fun of you.
We've been to Burning Man together. Was there any particular experience or memory that you have of Burning Man that was special for you or meaningful for you?
I think the most thrilling moments at Burning Man is when they burn the temple. And in the temple, people take pictures of loved ones that have passed away. They write poems on the building. It's just a space of just peace and love with thousands of people all sharing that moment.
It was really special the year that we went after Dad died and, you know, put up his photo on the temple and wrote messages to him. I thought it was really special because Dad, being a carpenter and being a woodworker, and we were able to honor him on such a beautiful piece of wood art. And I thought that was, you know, befitting. Thank you, Mom, for giving me this time today.
And maybe we can say it together.
Si se puede!
That was civil rights and labor leader Dolores Huerta and her daughter, Juana Chavez.
Creo lo imposible. Que la locura más cuerda es buscar cómo ser libre. Creo lo imposible. Que de nuestras espaldas brotarán las alas que nos harán volar invencible. Creo lo imposible. Que el simbo silenciará el efecto de sus misiles. Creo lo imposible. Creo que es posible hacer de este mundo.
This episode was produced by Sophia Paliza-Carr and edited by Marlon Bishop in partnership with WNYC Studios. If you'd like to hear more stories about the shifting dynamics of gender and power in our democracy today, check out their podcast, United States of Anxiety, at wnycstudios.org. The Latino USA team includes Miguel Macias, Antonia Cerejido, Maggie Freeling, Janice Yamoka, Sayer Quevedo, and Maya Cueva, with help from Fernanda Chavarri. Our engineer is Stephanie LeBeau. Additional engineering this week by Rebecca Weinman. Our production manager is Natalia Fidelholtz. Our fellow is Jesse Alejandro Cottrell. Our interns are Paula Mora and Comis Johnson. Our theme music was composed by Zenia Rubinos. And if you like the music you heard on this episode, stop by latinousa.org and check out our weekly Spotify playlist. Oh, and one more thing. If you go to Apple Podcasts and rate and review Latino USA, this really helps other listeners to find us. And the comments you write are so lovely. Keep them coming. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again on our next episode. And in the meantime, look for us on all of your social media. And I'll see you there. Hasta la próxima. And for this episode, si se puede. Chao.
This episode of NPR's Latino USA was made possible with support from the Rockefeller Brothers Fund, California Endowment, building a strong state by improving the health of all Californians, and Heising Simons Foundation, unlocking knowledge, opportunity, and possibilities. More at hsfoundation.org.
We're working on our Halloween costumes. We've all decided that as a staff, we're all going to be different kinds of bunnies, but Dolores, instead of the Energizer Bunny, is going to be the Organizer Bunny.
I'm Maria Hinojosa, and next time on Latino USA, what made Kevin De Leon take on one of the most powerful Democrats, Dianne Feinstein, in California this election season?
It's been close to two decades since Senator Feinstein has stepped off a debate stage, and that's unacceptable.
Why Latino progressives will keep on challenging the status quo in the Democratic Party. That's next time on Latino USA.
By midday on November 6, 1985, Colombia's Palace of Justice in Bogotá was a battleground. Guerrillas held dozens of hostages, and the army had the building surrounded. What happened that fateful day? This week on Radio Ambulante.